Welcome to the Oklahoma Memo Podcast, a conversation about politics, policy, and community that goes beyond the borders of our state. I'm your host and the curator of the Oklahoma Memo newsletter, Ryan Welton. I've been silenced by the threat of tomorrow. Welcome to the Oklahoma Memo Podcast. My name is Ryan Welton, the founder and creator and curator of Oklahoma Memo, your daily local newsletter that hits your inbox at 7 a.m. Monday through Saturday. And this is it's an Oklahoma Memo podcast with my friend Grant Herms. Make It Make Sense with Grant Herms. You can find him on Substack. You can find him on YouTube. And as we talked, Grant, before the show here, usually we have two or three things to talk about. We could talk about 11 things this week. So many things.
It has been like one of those weeks where, and I feel like we say this a lot, where the hits just keep coming. But like, as we were talking about like, hey, what do we want to like really nail down today? I was like, I just kept coming with things because it's been one of those weeks where it's been like not a ton of like big bombshell stuff like that has happened in a couple cases. Like it's just been like little drips all week long, right? Where I said to my wife last night, I was like, do you feel like this week has been really fast? Because I blinked and it was Thursday night. And she, who is also a executive producer, she works in the news, she was like, no, it's been the longest week in the world. I think because it's just been small drips for her all week long. But like, I feel like that has made this week go by super fast. And it's like almost like half the stuff that we knew at the beginning that we've forgotten because so much has happened.
Right. There are many things that we talked about. Should we talk about this? And then we're like, yeah, we should hit that a little bit. So viewer, listener, if we go a little fast paced today, you will understand why. And the first topic, I mean, let's just talk about the ceasefire situation in Iran. What is happening there? I know there's the Iran situation with the Strait of Hormuz. There's also Israel and Lebanon.
Yeah.
Where are we at as of Friday?
Sure. So as of today, we are under an indefinite ceasefire in the war in Iran. The Strait of Hormuz is still closed more or less indefinitely. I'm look here at the actual Strait of Hormuz tracker that I've got open. And as of right now, the Strait is only letting 5 ships through in the last 24 hours. 3, actually, as of today, as we're talking. So not great. That is way below the normal average, which is like 60.
You know, there should be a website called Is the Strait of Hormuz Open? And it's just yes or no.
There should be. It just says yes or no. Yeah, this one is just like HormuzStraitMonitor.com, and it shows you the flow and like all the oil and like the price of oil, which is now $99 a barrel, which is a little lower than it was yesterday. It tends to drop a little bit on Fridays as like we hit into the weekend. The market tends to expect the president to make some kind of announcement on Fridays to try to like stabilize things for the Monday bell. You can kind of set your watch to it at this point, kind of like what happened on Tuesday, where while we were heading into what was the end of the actual ceasefire agreement, the president just backed out. The taco effect, right? The Trump always chickens out effect, which at this point you could just count on it.
Right. This is factual. This really isn't an opinion at this point. He just backs out of things.
It is becoming an economic phenomenon. And like, I am wholeheartedly ripping that from an economist from the University of Michigan who was like tracking that at this point, because it is one of those things that the markets might be able to start actually using as like a predictor for how to set prices when the president says something and a deadline is showing up and he keeps blustering and he keeps saying these things and moving towards a much more maximalist position. And then push comes to shove, he'll take his ball and go home. And it's this thing. And I said it in the show yesterday, but it appears that the rules for a schoolyard bully are the same for the president, which is if you stand your ground, that bully is going to back down. And that has been the case for the president when it comes to Iran. It's been the case when it comes to tariffs. It's been the case when it's come to his latest legal fights. It has been the case when it's come to his pushes in Congress and the Senate on things like the Save America Act, the Voting Rights Voting Bill Act, not rights, it's Voter Fraud and Voter ID Bill Act. But like all those things, he's just sort of walked away from those. And we are in this space now. We have this indefinite ceasefire, which is handing Iran an awful lot of power, because the president said that we are going to wait until Iran gets a deal together, gives us a proposal, and then we're going to work it out from there. The president said one way or another, whatever that is actually meant to mean, no one seems to know.
And do you think the leaders of Iran are sitting back urgently creating this plan, or are they like, oh, we have time now?
I think they're like, we have time now. We have time now to rebuild our missile capabilities, our bunkers, which they were already rebuilding at a faster rate than the United States had predicted they were going to be able to do. They are certainly moving what nuclear material they have to more secure facilities. All the quote unquote nuclear dust that the president says he wants to go after, which he means to say is that we obliterated the nuclear stores they had to dust, and therefore the United States is going to have to go collect this nuclear white powder, as he calls it, with like some sort of anti-Chernobyl Dyson vacuum of some kind, which like also isn't a thing. Like, I don't know what the president is being told, but like that doesn't make any logical sense. Apart from it being incredibly dangerous for like the rest of Iran and the Middle East to have like nuclear waste just floating around.
Nobody wants nuclear waste in the neighborhood.
Right. And like, I know all this sounds like also that we're criticizing the fact that there's a ceasefire right now. The peace is a good thing, right? The fact that there's not bombs being actively dropped on people and bridges and power plants and those things is good. Like, no one should, you know, balk at that part of this. It's just that the president had a deadline, was talking a really big game, and then walked backwards, which just handed Iran more power in this thing. We also learned this week that the United States is rapidly running out of missiles, which we knew already was happening, but like we're now getting a much better picture of where things are at, and we have really depleted our capabilities when it comes to Tomahawks and interceptors and just kind of some basic munitions that we had specifically in the Middle East, but then we had also shipped some from like Asia and the South China Sea, and so now there are some worries about protecting Taiwan, should China get wily here. And when we talk about, and because the president's been vocal about this, when we talk about rebuilding our missile supplies and you know, revamping, you know, getting places like Lockheed or Northrop Grumman or other major weapon suppliers and manufacturers to build these missiles again, they can't do them in weeks. They would not be ready in time. We are talking in terms of many months, like in years, 46 months, 50 months kind of a thing to get back up to decent levels. But it takes several months just to build one of those missiles. So, you know, we're running into problems here. And that's not good. And the Pentagon knows that. And the Pentagon has been telling the president that. The Pentagon has been telling Congress that. And we're running into a part of what this is now, which is starting to leave the president with very few options, because we know from history that the kind of air power supremacy that the United States has said it has had over Iran, that doesn't lead to the kind of changes that the United States has wanted. It never has in the history of human flight. It's never happened. We also know that naval blockades, like the one that we're running in the Strait of Hormuz, those also don't force countries to capitulate. Even in the cases where it has worked in history, and I'm pulling this from a defense specialist at Defense Priorities, cases specifically like the Confederacy in the Civil War and Imperial Germany, where there were naval blockades, it took massive ground forces and invasions that way, and years of war in order to break those armies and those imperiums. It wasn't the naval blockades on their own. And the president doesn't want to send troops into Iran. So we're running out of options here about what to do next, especially if we're running out of missiles and we're running out of time.
So before we went on air, if you will, here, mm-hmm. I had mentioned, I said, so I see that the president was kicked out of the Situation Room, and there are reports that that was the case. And I don't know how one kicks the president out of the Situation Room, but it's clear that maybe they're at loggerheads. You know, it's they're getting frustrated with the president.
It seems to be pretty clear from, like, when you put all the reporting together from what's been happening inside the White House when it comes to strategic talks about Iran, that the president's presence in those things is no longer helpful. that, yes, he's still the president, has the final say in these conversations, but he's no longer helpful in deliberations. He's no longer helpful in putting together a slate of options for what the United States military might be able to do. It's unclear if he ever really was, but he is much more in terms of how these meetings operate. It seems from the reporting, I'm not in these rooms, right? But it seems from the reporting, at least, that he's much more willing to interrupt, and he is much more willing to be suspicious of motives of his own people, of members of the military. He is much more worried about the optics of what it would mean for his own personal legacy versus the outcome of this war. Much less concerned about the impact on Americans when it comes to like keeping the Strait of Hormuz closed, which we found out this week. The Pentagon has been telling Congress that it will take 6 months to open the Strait of Hormuz.
This is going to be a good segue into our next topic.
Yes, it will. Yes. But like the president is acting erratically in a way that nobody can predict. And so this is from the new Wall Street Journal report that was out this week. The president has been, you know, privately grappling with the war in Iran. And by that, they mean his own personal legacy about this. And so when you get these long streams of unhinged posts or whatever, or he threatens Iran with civilization erasure, or the Easter Sunday post where he says, you know, open the effing straight, you crazy bastards, and then says, praise be to Allah or whatever. Like, those aren't attached to any kind of national security or military foreign policy plan. He just is doing them without anything else. So he gets booted from the Situation Room because that's the guy walking in there. And all these, you know, military members and intelligence community officers and people who have plans and aims to try to have some kind of actual victory and end this thing can't do that and handle the president at the same time. Because when the president speaks, they are duty bound, oath bound to listen to what he has to say and try to make those things happen. And if that changes hour by hour, or, you know, to social post by post, they can't do their jobs. And so it's increasingly unhelpful to have him in those rooms. And by and large, most of these military members want to do their job effectively. They want to do it by the letter of the law and international law, because they understand that not following those things actually creates more problems down the road. And they want this to be over. They want to do this the right way. And
they're like Jerry Maguire. Help me help you.
Very much
help me help you.
Very, very much so. And I think that you kind of get a sense that the people who are the most forcefully pushing back on those things are the ones that have targets on their back for Pete Hegseth to take aim at. That wasn't the case this week with the resignation of the Navy Secretary. That had way more to do with Trump wanting a new fleet of naval warships, the Trump class ships that we couldn't get built in time. And the Navy Secretary was actually just Trump's like golfing buddy and wasn't qualified to do that gig. And so like couldn't make this thing happen because he can't speed up the passage of time.
So
he's not a wizard and couldn't build these ships faster than they can get built. And so Trump fired him because he was angry and had to fire somebody.
It does seem like a thread from The Apprentice. You weren't able to get these built in time and the deadline is passed.
Right.
Fired.
Right. Right. Exactly. It was just like, oh, I'm sorry. You couldn't turn these dinosaur bones into oil by pressing them with your hands together. So like you're fired. Like that's what he was asking this guy to do. In some small way, his firing was probably a mercy to him. But like, regardless, the president's behavior is what gets him booted from this room here. But we should talk about this Pentagon report and gas prices.
The power of a newsletter isn't the click, it's the relationship. Same thing for the podcast, and your marketing plan needs both. Why? To increase leads, to close sales, and to make loyalty your business's superpower. Hi, I'm Ryan, the founder and curator of Oklahoma Memo and host of the Oklahoma Memo podcast, and I could be doing this for you. Call me at 405-358-7184 or email me at ryan@doabledigitalmedia.com. Now, back to the show.
Yeah, so, you know,
bringing it back to Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And I've seen gas go up, but still it's high. There's high gas prices, and then there's high for Oklahoma. And right now I think we're, I didn't look at the exact, we're in the threes somewhere, I think.
Yeah, mid threes, I think, is what it was yesterday. I double checked. And nationally right now it's like at 401 or 402 on average. And like I said last week, gas prices are about 30 days behind the price of oil, just given how shipping and refining and all those things work. So think about where we were a month ago and then think about, what's coming.
So what you're saying, Grant, is that the prices will be all better by July, right?
Totally better. They'll be way better. Like, we haven't even hit the part of oil per barrel price yet where we were worried about it hitting $200. Like, we haven't even hit the part where oil hit $150 a barrel yet in gas prices. That hasn't hit our pumps yet. So that's coming. And like, that would put, I think, Oklahoma gas up above $4. When the heartland, when the middle of the country sees $4 a gallon gas, that is a different story economically. That is a different story politically. Much more importantly, economically, that is shipping costs, that is trucking costs, that is, right, that's fuel costs, right, that is every trucker running straight through Oklahoma, that is every trucker running up through Texas and Kansas and, through the crossroads of America, having to stop for fuel, or companies being forced to limit their shipments because they can't afford the fuel, which means food coming from ports on the East and West Coast is rotting in warehouses, or food coming from the middle of the country can't get out because it can't be shipped out. That is people who can't afford to drive to work because commutes are longer for a lot of people who drive a lot longer in those places because their distances are longer. It's bad. It's really bad.
And so, viewer, listener, if you'll just go back to the pandemic era and how bad the supply chain was there, different circumstances, of course, but when gas prices get high enough, you have truckers, professional drivers who they drive for professional driving companies, Werner and whatnot, and then you have independent truck drivers, right, who are just as important. They're the ones who are going to have to say, I got to work, but I can't afford the gas. And so your bread and milk might not get to the shelves this week.
Right, right. And then, like, we're also talking about things like shipping lumber or paper products, right? And so then that's housing, or shipping steel, and that's construction costs. That's, we are talking those things, and that all trickles down through businesses to jobs. And then we get into jobs being harmed likely right around Halloween. If the Strait, like the Pentagon is telling Congress, can't get open for 6 months, if the war ends tomorrow, which it's not going to, but if it does, it will take 6 months for the Strait to open up relatively normally again. In reality, this thing, let's say it ends in a month, generously 2 weeks. Okay. We're looking at it not being open until the midterms. And then to get back up to full speed again, really, it's around Christmas time. That is through school supply shopping. That is through holiday shopping. That is oil that is needed, not just for fuel and those things, but also for plastics products, electronics that need to be shipped, rare earth minerals that need to be put in things like semiconductor chips that get then shipped to car manufacturers in places like here in Detroit, where I am. That means the cost of school supplies, clothes for school, shoes for school, gifts for the holidays, car prices, used car prices, those are all going to go through the roof. Like, we're running again, like the pandemic is a really good example of this. Remember all those price shifts. We're going to run into that again, but this time it's not a global pandemic causing these supply chain issues. It's this war that we chose to get into. Like, this is all happening for like really predictable reasons. And I think that's the part that's like really souring a lot of people here on this, which it gets into the political side of this. which is the president then got his worst polling he's ever had this week. I mean, his approval rating, depending on the poll you look
Jimmy
at. Jimmy Carter level polling, to the president's great chagrin, right? Like, that's his boogeyman is Jimmy Carter, because I think the president kind of, as an adult, like, politically pops online in the 70s, really. And like, that's his world. In the 70s, you've got a president who is facing a crisis in Iran, an oil and gas crisis, a untrusting American public post-Vietnam, and you've got an American public that is pessimistic about the future of the country. And all of that is true now in America, you know, with the I guess, exception of Vietnam. But you could probably wrap in the specter of the war on terror in Afghanistan and Iraq looming right now over, you know, what is the war in Iran, and fit that kind of into that same place. So you've got all that there. The president's approval ratings are between 30 and 33%. His floor used to be about 40%. So that is wild. Those are Bush, W. Bush 2 numbers. Like, that is, you know, crazy. His approval rating on the economy, whether he's doing a good job on that, is 30%. His approval rating on cost of living is 23%. Yeah, his Republicans then are now no longer seen as better on the economy than Democrats or cost of living for the first time since 2010, which, if Republicans could rely on anything, generally speaking, it is that the American public thinks that Republicans are better for the economy than Democrats. For lots of reasons, a lot of that has to do with that Republicans for many years have aligned themselves with being the party of business and money, and therefore, like, fiscally responsible and those kind of things. And for lack of a better way to say this, like, Americans think of Republicans as like the daddy party. And I don't know,
Warbucks.
Yeah. Kind of a thing. And like, they're generally like the rich people party or whatever, even though that's not the case anymore.
So I'll tell you, before Trump was elected, and I worked at Love's Travel Stops at country stores, executives are up there talking, and one of them said, "You look, I don't know what's going to happen with the company, but I just know he's an S corp, and so we're going to be okay," or something like that. And I know now what that means a little bit, so it doesn't really make sense to me, because a lot of businesses are S corps, but they always figure that a rich guy kind of has their back. And you would think, Grant, that he would have the best economists talking to him and giving him the straight scoop. And that's clearly not happening.
No. And like, I think that's there's an actual name for this fallacy, but like, it's a logical fallacy that you see a lot of these people fall into. And it's that, like, they made their money because they were just smarter and better than everybody else. And not that they, like, were lucky. And I'm not saying that, like, you know, that they don't have an innate sense for some of these things. They weren't, you know, good at capitalizing on being in the right place at the right time.
Right. And but incredibly also, hard workers, too.
Yeah. And like, that's all possible. Right. And that's all part of it. But it's not solely because of those things. And certainly with the president, right, like, inherited lots of money, was used that money then to be able to be in lots of rooms and, like, be in places that allowed him to then use the money he inherited to do those things. And then not for nothing, but like, run a lot of scams and like, make money doing those things, and then avail himself of the legal system that we have that allows very wealthy people to do lots of things while retaining a lot of money. And like, that's the way he operates. And so like, they, you know, people see Republicans as through that lens. And like, that's a part of our own cultural psyche too. This pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, pioneering, you know, sort of build it from nothing kind of rags to riches thing, the American story thing, even though when you look at a lot of these people, that's almost nobody, almost ever. And like, which I know sounds awful, but like, it just is historically true. So there's all that happening right now because of all the polling numbers and all those things that's happening right now because of this Iran war. And that is also happening before primaries happen. And we're heading into a midterm where the president is also going to get shellacked because it's the midterms, and that happens anyway. And it was already going to happen. And if gas prices stay above $4 a gallon nationally, and they hit $4 in the middle of the country by, by Labor Day, likely before that, by the 4th of July, for America's 250th birthday, what we've got is gas lines and food shortages. That's wild. While the president is building a ballroom and an arch to triumph and you know, racing Formula One down D.C., like, that is, the split screens of those things is a powerful message and will not go unnoticed.
Right. So I have an idea, and maybe this has been pitched to the president. Maybe it hasn't. But let's go ahead and reclassify marijuana, and let's get into psychedelics. We can take the edge off. Take the edge off, you know? As you noted before that we went on air, let's get high about it.
Yeah, get high about it. Yeah, because, like, those things didn't happen this week. So, like, I Monday or Tuesday this week, like, Joe Rogan is in the Oval Office because the president is working to decriminalize or lower the status of some psychedelic drugs.
And by the way, breaking news this morning, the FDA cleared a path for this to happen.
Yes, yes. Surprise, surprise. And it's because, as Joe Rogan put it, in the Oval Office, he texted Trump and said, "Hey, I want to get this done." And the president was like, "Yeah, you want FDA approval? Not like, let's look into it. Let's have the FDA look into it. Like, you just want approval." Like, it could have been anything, right? It could have been like, "Hey, I want to fast track meth." Like,
the president was like, "Angel dust, angel dust."
Right. You could have called it anything. And the president, no. And, like, to be fair, there's a lot of work that's been done on the kind of psychedelics that Joe Rogan is talking about here that have helped a lot of people. And there is a really good write up in the New York Times this week about how this stuff works and that it's helped a lot of people. And so, like, there is some real merit here. And I guess credit to Joe Rogan for seeing his opening and, like, maybe getting some help to people who really need it. But there's that there. The timing of this thing. And then yesterday, the DOJ just announces that it's decriminalizing is not the right word. I should stop saying that. It is lowering the classification of medicinal marijuana in states where it's medical and down to a level 3. And they started this process back in December and officially did it this, you know, yesterday in this executive order through the president and everything else. And it's not decriminalization because only Congress can do that, which is why I have to be careful about saying that. But it's the timing of this is just like, why now? It's both of these things are very random. They are pretty popular with people. So it's just like the president is just like, what do we like? We like the drugs, right? They're like, just let them get high about it. Maybe they won't notice. If they're too stoned.
They like the weed.
Yeah. Yeah. If they're too stoned, they won't notice that gas is $5. Like,
might be a little truth to that. But I will tell you, even Nixon, I've been a student of the presidency forever. Even Nixon gets credit for China and gets credit for being a good president on the environment. Could this be like the thing that, you know, Trump is concerned about his legacy? You want to have like one or two things that people say, you know, he wasn't a very good president, but he did this.
You know, maybe I will caution that because like that's sort of a history hindsight thing in the way that in Trump's first term, I think people should rightfully give Trump credit for his administration's overseeing Operation Warp Speed for the mRNA vaccines.
100%, right.
Now, like, saved millions of lives, and studies have credited that, right? Now, did he and the rest of his ilk turn their backs on that project and defund all of the future studying
and hire RFK Jr.
Right. To ruin the next likely 20 years of mRNA research, which will mean that we have to go hat in hand to Europe and China to get the next stage of these things that could be absolute game changers for medicine. Yeah. Yeah. They did all that, but like they were the first, they got it out quickly. They shared it and saved lives. So like that happened under Trump and that was good. And there's no bones about that. It is one of those things though, where like, I think in this scale of history, will presidential historians, you know, look at this and how much of what's happening now, like will magic mushrooms and semi-legal weed outweigh what's been done in the Oval Office in terms of things like corruption and the war in Iran and threats against immigrants and voting rights and, you know, the rest of it, right? Like, I don't No, it doesn't feel like it right now, but I guess who knows?
You've been talking about this quite a bit. He has sort of a crisis of believability.
Yes.
You know, he does this, takes it back. And I know people like to pejoratively say, you know, taco. And at this point, it's just become a pattern. It will become sort of like an economic philosophy that economists and scholars discuss down the road. But he's also having a crisis of believability with these late night unhinged posts on Truth Social, and he's sort of working out this persona of a madman because he thinks it's strategic.
Yeah, it's this thing where, and like the idea of a madman theory is a real thing. So like from a political science, political theory standpoint, this is a thing. It was one of Richard Nixon's favorite things to do, especially during Vietnam, is that he would get in a room with advisors and be like, I'm crazy. Tell them I'm crazy. Tell them I can't be reasoned with you. Don't know what I'm going to do next. And this is the best deal that they're going to get because it's the deal that I want right now. But you don't know where I'm going to go next. And like, it could be worse, could be scarier. But like, if you don't sign it, do it now. Like, it's very much like a MLM pressure kind of thing, right? Like the high sell, hard.
You're
hard
at
pressure.
A car place trying to get a used car, and they say, I ask my manager. And then the manager comes out and says, the deal's off the table. You must leave. You know?
Yeah. If you walk away now, you'll never get this deal again,
and
kind
we,
of
we
thing.
And we keep your down payment.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's that kind of a thing. And Trump is doing some of that. But like I said before, none of that is attached to any national security or foreign policy plans. So there's no way to know what he's doing or thinking at any given moment. And in the way that Trump behaves, he doesn't seem to know what that's going to be either. He is just reaction. He doesn't have a 5D chess plan, because if he did, you wouldn't get these very reliable, you know, taco moments, right? You wouldn't get these back down moments or these like indefinite ceasefire extension moments, because he wouldn't need breathing room because he'd have a plan. And so those late night posting things, and also like there's also quite a bit of what we should talk about, like the presidential health concerns involved in some of those posts too. It's not just the, you know, the moments in which like the president is saying privately that like, oh, I did that on purpose. It's the other stuff. It's the like toggling around from, you know, from posting a video of Frank Sinatra singing My Way about like, the end is near to posting about the board of Netflix, to posting about Chuck Schumer, to posting about, you know, the Supreme Court, to posting memes, like, it, you know, all those things. He's just posting almost once a minute for several hours at a time, late night, you know, into the early morning, 2 a.m., 4 a.m. You know, he's up, he's not sleeping.
And I think that's key because he doesn't drink, he doesn't take drugs at all. But what he's on is probably a hallucinogenic lack of sleep bender.
Right, right. Yeah, like, you know, whatever is keeping him up at night, whether it's stress, whether it's just, you know, as you get older, your sleep cycle changes, your circadian rhythm changes, right? Like,
it.
Just right. Yeah. Right. I mean, like, sure.
I've been up for 3 days.
No. Yeah. Yeah. Blue plate specials at noon. Yeah. Yes. Like, you know, so whatever, right? It's whatever that stuff is. But what all that means then is that we don't really know what the president is thinking or saying or what he means as true or not. And in the Wall Street Journal article this week, we also got a glimpse into this where he's been calling reporters or letting them call him on his personal phone, which there are two points to this. The first one is that is a very old, like, tabloid style way to get a hold of somebody. It's very Trump in the 80s New York Post stuff, which is interesting because it's a reversion for the president. It's it lets him control his specific message in a way that he likes, but it's also like where he's comfortable in that tabloid world, which strikes me as interesting, in the same sort of like mental health reasons we were just kind of talking about. But also, like, it allows the president to never be in front of a room full of reporters. It allows him to say things and control his message without having to actually answer hard questions, because at any moment he can just hang up, which he does frequently. He just says, okay, thanks, bye, and like hangs up. When reporters give you the transcripts of these things, you know, there's not ever time for a follow-up. These are like 5 to 7 minute conversations. But he will frequently tell Caroline Leavitt, the press secretary, hey, I talked to a reporter today. You'll have to wait till the press briefing to figure out who it is and what news I broke.
And for folks who don't understand how press secretaries work or PR managers,
yes,
that is the grandest of no-nos. That you, at some point, you start to feel sorry for Caroline Leavitt because it's like it puts her in an untenable position.
Yes. Like, it is just, her whole job is managing what information is flowing to the press
for the benefit of her boss.
Yes. And like the benefit of the White House. And like, to some degree, like, she has a responsibility to things like national security for those reasons. Like, and yes to the press and yes to the American public. But like, those are all wrapped in together. But if she doesn't know what the president is saying to who and what he's saying, like, and how much he's divulging, she can't explain these things. And so she doesn't know what she needs to be prepped on. And so she also doesn't know what she's allowed to say and not say, specifically from things like national security reasons, to a reporter who might then have a follow-up question to the president's 5-minute conversation about Iran. It is insane. It is just insane. And then you get this thing, too, where that's happening. The president's calling these reporters, talking to these reporters. He's giving them conflicting information. It's part of the reason why the ceasefire in general and these peace talks broke down with Iran, because they, like, the president is just saying things all over the place and no one knows what the White House is doing next. And now it's this point where I'm not sure it's worth reporting what the president is saying unless you can get it duly verified, because it just might not be true. Because he's just said things this week that just were flat out lies. They just were proven to be wholly false. And he seems to have made them up wholesale to no end without any sort of goal in mind. And that's a problem. I don't know what to do with that as a reporter, to be honest.
Right, except put a caveat on note, this came directly from the president, so there hasn't really been any double source verification.
Right.
You know, you have to put a caveat on anything, which doesn't help his credibility whatsoever.
No.
And then, by the way, all this stuff is in the presidential record. So if you're concerned about legacy, I mean, this is going to be a big part of it. The fact that he had a penchant for, let's just face it, folks, they are lies, but it's also, he just has sort of an imagination and he tells untruths. Some people would call that lying, of course, but I think it's more of a, he's just making stuff up.
Yeah, he's just spinning yarns, man. He's just out here confabulating stuff and like, I think to a certain degree he believes it. I think that to a certain degree he,
you
like,
say it enough, you believe it.
Yeah, I think to a certain degree too that he lives in a very specific kind of framework in his brain where if he says a thing that maybe isn't true now, it might be true soon. And if he just says it enough, it'll happen. Like, kind of in like, not in like a woo-woo manifest kind of a way,
right.
But like it's, that's sort of how he's operated for probably the last 30 years of his life. Is that he's had quite enough power and money that if he's just said a thing so many times, somebody around him has just made it happen. And I think now he's running into a point in which, like, he just can't do that. Partly because, you know, that's not the way the world works anymore. Partly because he is losing power by the day as we close to the end of his term. He is losing power as we close to the midterms. And then also, and I think this is a decent segue here, he's losing people in the White House and his administration, and MAGA is having a problem with getting people to fill those roles because they're, and this is coming from an administration official, MAGA is having trouble finding people who are both loyal to their cause and competent. Those two, seemingly, according to this person who's doing the hiring, are frequently mutually exclusive. And that is a problem for them.
So if you're advising Caroline Leavitt, we've both been in journalism, and I've got somewhat of a PR background and have done corporate communications. You empathize with her a little bit because she actually the greatest press secretary of all time, C.J. Craig from West Wing, she would go into President Bartlet and says, Mr. President, you can't do this. And if he refuses to do it, you have to offer your resignation.
Yes. I mean, like, if I was her, I would quit.
Yeah, right. And by the way, great segue to our next topic.
Yes.
You know, so, yeah. But, yeah, you just have to quit in her position. But
she has been sending up some signals lately that seem like she's distancing herself a little bit. She's been saying some things like, you know, that's a purely political question that might be better directed for someone like Stephen Miller, kind of a thing. Like, she's starting to, like, take a couple steps.
So maybe back. She's thinking about her legacy. You know, much like that you had Jen Psaki, and then I forgot the press secretary who's the second one. So she had like a peer or something. I forgot what her name was.
Yeah.
But she wrote a book afterwards.
Yes.
And I'm sure Caroline will also.
Yes. She will. I'm assuming so. Yeah.
Her name is like Jean Saint Pierre or something like that.
Yeah. What was her first name? I could see her face.
Yeah.
Short woman.
Yeah.
Curly hair.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
She was great.
Yeah. Yeah.
So off to the segue for the next topic, though. Resignations. All of a sudden, I mean, each week we're having to keep tabs on who's resigning from Congress, who's resigning from the cabinet, who's getting fired or about to get fired. What was the damage this week? The carnage.
Right. So after we talked last week, Todd Lyons, the director of ICE, announced that he was leaving at the end of May. That sounds like a dude who was just out because he is done with the gig. Obviously another DHS scalp on the way out of this administration under immense scrutiny after all of the problems with ICE. But specifically a record number of deaths in ICE detentions in fiscal year for 2026 and a more deaths in fiscal year 2026 than all of Trump's first term, which is an atrocity. I don't know what else to call it. Like, that people should not be dying in government custody in this way. They're being held
100%.
For trial. They're being held for deportation. This should not be happening.
And by the way, yeah. For Oklahoma viewers, same goes for the Oklahoma County Detention Center.
Right. These aren't places where people should be dying, and they certainly shouldn't be dying at record levels.
Right.
These deaths, people have medical emergencies, deaths happen, fights happen, those things happen in these situations. They should be few and far between, and they should be shocking when they happen, and reports and audits should happen, and they should be scandals when they happen. They should not be run-of-the-mill things that we don't hear about. Like, it's a travesty. Because we are paying for it, right? Like, that's the point I'm making here, is that these are tax-funded things. So Todd Lyons is out. It also means that DHS now is setting itself up to really have a lot of open space to ramp up to what looks to be a much more aggressive DHS and ICE enforcement come 2027. Now, the midterms could change a lot of that. That's a different episode, different conversation. The Labor Secretary is out as well. Lori Chavez de Remer, she was out amid massive scandals and accusations of sexual assault and harassment and alleged affair with her security detail and a potential staff, another staffer, alleged sexual assault committed by her husband against a staffer, so much that he was banned from the Department of Labor building, another similar allegation levied against her father by staffers. She was accused of sexually harassing other staffers, including like getting them to like bring wine to her hotel room. She brought staffers to a strip club that was not like a nice one either. It was like it was called Angels, and it was like a little like
it's underground. You go downstairs to go into it.
No, it's worse. Do you know what is the name? Do you know the place called The Flea? I don't know why I know this. The Flea, it's across the street from the Oklahoma County Jail.
I don't, but I'm not surprised.
It is a dive bar.
Okay. It's okay. I absolutely know what that is. It's not a strip club, right?
No, but it's made out of cinder blocks. It's a bar. It's not a strip club.
Yeah, yeah.
It's made out of cinder blocks. That is what this strip club where the labor secretary and her staffer
That's not a sentence that we should be saying, even.
No. Like, that is what this place was. It also, funnily enough, has a, I looked it up on Google Maps because I was like, where is this place? It has like a food to go sign on the outside, like a little sandwich board, like just in case you went to the strip club and no. wanted the wings to go. No. I don't know. Whatever. But like, so that happens. She leaves. She was also accused of being drunk at work multiple times. Right.
Hello, Keshe Patel.
Yeah. Well, we could talk about him next. And there is an Office of Inspector General report expected to come out about the now former labor secretary soon, likely this afternoon in the afternoon news dump.
Before we talk about anybody else, though, yeah. this goes back to what you were saying last week. How do we were talking about Congress. How do you get better people elected? You can't have better people appointed until you have better people elected.
Right. Right. This is a failing of Congress and of specifically the Senate to confirm her. Now, she had a lot of backing from unions. She was like labor secretary under Donald Trump was not a, like a high prize position, right? Under a Republican president, the labor secretary was just generally in charge of working conditions and unions and those things, like not a Republican president's priority. Generally.
Making sure the workers don't revolt.
Yeah, kind of a thing. But again, in talking about like a revamping of DHS and immigration enforcement, like labor secretary also has a hand in things like workplace raids. They're involved in those. And if what it appears that the administration would like to ramp up to deport a million people next year or by next year, a new labor secretary that would be on board with allowing someone like Secretary Marquin Mullen to raid not just places like farms, but like tech companies, a labor secretary would be involved in that. Or like auto plants here in Detroit or whatever, like they would be involved in that. So, you know, that position wasn't exactly what Trump had in mind, but it might be now. And so her leaving now is actually an opening for that kind of a thing. But that's not really what this is about. Right. She wasn't asked to leave so they could do this thing. She was asked to leave for scandal. Yeah. And then we get this thing from The Atlantic over the last weekend about Keshe Patel, where The Atlantic talked to more than two dozen FBI sources who said that Keshe Patel is frequently drunk on the job because the FBI director is a 24/7 job. He spends his weekends in Las Vegas in private clubs, which are not that private because they're open to American Express card holders. One of them is called the Poodle Room, where he is visibly publicly drunk frequently, according to these sources. And on frequent occasions, especially early when he was FBI director, they had to move meetings because he was so drunk from the night before that he had to sleep it off. On at least one occasion, on multiple occasions, they had trouble rousing him because he was so drunk from the night before. On at least one occasion, they had to call for breaching equipment to get into his room because they couldn't wake the FBI director, which would be like battering rams and crowbars that are used by SWAT teams to enter houses. And they also described him as paranoid and suspicious of people and prone to jumping to conclusions, which is definitely what you want in an FBI director.
It's also perfect for this administration.
Yes. It's yes.
Without the drinking, because Trump, without the drinking, he doesn't do that.
Right. Right. So like this comes out in The Atlantic, and Keshe Patel, you know, who has just had a series of like foibles and bungles this the entire time. Like, again, a dude who really wasn't really qualified to do this gig
in the first place.
He is a low level DOJ staffer and then a staffer on the Hill and then, you know, gets kicked out of the DOJ, has an axe to grind. It's like a decent DOJ staffer. Like he really was decent lawyer, but has an axe to grind, realizes that he can make a bunch of money in the right wing grift circuit, does that, falls into this machine, writes a couple children's books about Donald Trump and like the Russia investigation and stuff, and then becomes this dude. And that's how he gets into the good graces.
You talked about this last week. You get elected, you get appointed, and then a different persona.
Yes. And like, and then he becomes FBI director. And like, he's a lawyer, sure, but like, he was just never qualified to do this job.
Gravitas. He does not have it for this. These FBI folks are serious people.
Yes. And like, you know, he even go back to like the Charlie Kirk shooting, right? He runs with a bad tip that they caught the suspect before they actually caught a suspect. They release these messages that now have disappeared in this case, that appear to have been hastily put together. Potentially wholly fabricated or hastily edited to make it look like it was one conversation. But, you know, likely separate text messages that were just put in the same thread. But either way, like they released this thing. There is another shooting in Texas at an ICE facility in which like evidence is released by Cash Patel's Twitter account. He has jumped to other several conclusions of things online. And then like this story comes out. Cash Patel is now suing The Atlantic for $250 million. How he lands in that number, no one seems to know. It might be tied to the fact that it's America's 250th anniversary, and that's a nice round number that Trump might like.
I think you're right.
But like in that lawsuit is riddled with errors. It also says that like nobody has concerns about Cash Patel's behavior across the government, which is a wild claim to make. And like, you know, in the article itself, Patel's colleagues are like, we're kind of worried that he's a threat to public safety, which would belay those concerns. But also he's trying to prove what's called the actual malice standard. And for listeners, in defamation cases, that would mean that the reporter in this case would have to listen to all these 24 sources or 24 plus sources, go through what is a pretty rigorous process at The Atlantic of fact checking, and then ignore that fact checking process, have the editors of The Atlantic ignore that process, and then run this story because they hate Cash Patel so much that they just want to impugn him and tear him down. He has to prove that. And that's a really high bar. And like, that's just probably not going to happen here.
If you're listener, if you're just not aware of this, but journalists don't go into those situations to impugn people out of the blue. In fact, Sarah Fitzpatrick, who I believe was the author of the article, if it had come back that actually Cash Patel was upstanding and an awesome boss, that would have been the story.
Yes, absolutely. That's an equally interesting article. Like, and like also if Cash Patel is like just a regular boss, also an interesting article. Like, like no matter what comes out of that thing, that's an interesting article about like the inner workings of the
guy's guy, and he happens to be good to his staff.
Yeah, like
great story.
Like Cash Patel on Fox News is this like bug-eyed blowhard, but like behind closed doors, like people like him and he brings cupcakes to work and like it's casual Fridays and there's donuts. Like what a story. Like I would have loved, God, what I would give, what I would give for that to have been the story, Ryan. And like, oh my God.
Reporters, you have to check twice, three times as hard when you can't believe what you're hearing.
Yes. And so but the story is the story now, right? And the thing is that Cash Patel has been circling this chopping block of being fired for a long time, specifically since the Charlie Kirk stuff. And this kind of a headline is not good for Trump. It's the kind of headline that Trump hates. It sucks a lot of oxygen away from Trump. It makes Trump look bad and stupid. And then it has the alcohol thing involved, too. And Trump is a teetotaler. He doesn't like people to get publicly drunk. He tolerates Pete Hegseth, who, you know, as far as I understand, like is sober and is not drinking. Obviously, people joke and there are rumors. But like, as far as we all know, like, provably he is still on the wagon.
Yeah.
And like is not drinking on the job. And so like, you know, Trump is not a fan of this kind of drinking.
Yeah.
And like,
for those who don't know, it was his brother was.
Yes.
Out, yeah.
And it's of I believe his alcoholism killed him. And like it's an awful way to go. And like and so like, you know, it affected Trump immensely. And he's talked about that. And maybe, you know, in the only times I've ever seen Trump really be empathetic or sympathetic or emotional about anything, it's the death of his brother and that struggle, which is is an interesting thing. But so like this is not a thing that Trump likes. And I would not be surprised if like Kash Patel is the next one to go here. The thing is, like I said before, is that they already can't replace the attorney general. They already can't replace, you know, the now the labor secretary and the head of ICE. And
because you can't find somebody who's both competent and willing to be loyal.
Right. Right. And to do what it takes. And so like they're going to struggle to find somebody to fill the role of an FBI director. And Patel, to try to save his skin here, is now saying that they're going to come out with a bunch of arrests in the 2020 election case, which like, OK, I guess if you arrest people, fine. But like they brought up, you know, former FBI director Jim Comey. That case was thrown on merit. And like there have been a couple others. They'll go after these people. They'll bring up cases. They'll do stuff. But like they won't last in court. It just won't happen.
Well, let's segue into the next topic as we near the end of the hour. But the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Yeah.
I got an indictment this week. And we, you know, I had to ask, I said, what exactly is this about? So could you just brief people on what the indictment is about? And do you think it holds water?
Yeah. So this is an indictment from a grand jury, which was presented with a case from the Department of Justice that the Department of Justice is alleging, I believe it's like 15 counts of certain financial crimes, wire fraud, defrauding donors, bank fraud, for, according to the DOJ, misleading donors to prop up hate and extremist groups. The Southern Poverty Law Center is a storied civil rights organization that has spent its career working to dismantle groups like the KKK, the American Nazi Party. The Islamic Brotherhood, but every extremist group in the United States has
they're an equal opportunity dismantler.
Yes. Yes. The John Birch Society. They are an equal opportunity dismantler across the board. And in this indictment, the DOJ is alleging that the SPLC, through what is a confidential informant operation the SPLC used to run, was paying to have groups like the KKK stay in business in order to, in their narrative, manufacture extremism so that the SPLC could stay in business and make money and everyone gets rich and goes home happy. And it basically breeds this thing for the political right that nobody is extreme. And it was always this false flag operation from the left, which born out in our politics, that does not make any sense. I mean, the policies that are coming out of this White House, the things that are being said by people like Stephen Miller, things that are being said by members of Congress, like it would mean that then they are all dupes for this plan from the left. That also doesn't make sense.
There's a saying I see on social sometimes: every accusation is a revelation. Mm-hmm. You know, when they say this, I just feel like they're talking about themselves.
Yeah, every accusation is an admission, right? Yeah, it's that. And so it is. It's that thing, and like that. So that thing doesn't hold water. The thing to know about grand juries is that they don't hear the other side of this case. It's an indictment. It means that the grand jury finds that there is reason to go to trial, that they're presented with the prosecution side of this case. And the grand jury goes, yeah, there's enough evidence here where this should go to a judge and a jury. It's not like an indictment is, you know, the first step in this, right? Like there's enough evidence here that a jury of these peers thought that this should move forward. That's still something. It's not nothing. But there is an old saying that like a prosecutor could indict a ham sandwich because there's no defense, right? They tell you this narrative, they bring you the evidence, and that's what happens. And you know, oftentimes in these indictments, those things hold up. Just as often, they don't. So it's only the first step, and the DOJ is acting like this is a conviction. of this thing, and that their narrative is is the end all be all, which they have to, right? You know, no prosecutor is going to be like, we brought it, but like, we'll see what happens in court. Like, they're not going to say that.
Right.
But also this program is incredibly common. What the SPLC was doing was getting insiders to feed them information. And you know, there are accusations that they, like, the SPLC was coaching these people to coordinate rallies and things, specifically like the Unite the Right rally in 2017, which led to the death of, I believe, two people. For sure, one woman was hit and killed by a car that was barreling through that rally. But that was the big one in Virginia, where neo-Nazis stormed Charlottesville and said, "Jews will not replace us." And that was the one where president said that there were fine people on both sides, I assume, or whatever he said. You know, they like to quibble now that the president wasn't actually calling Nazis good or whatever, but right. You could watch the tape and he did.
Right.
Like, you know, the DOJ is now working, the SPLC was basically ran that rally, which they did not. It's a stretch to say that using confidential informants is the same thing as propping up these organizations.
You had an example before we went on air. You said it would be like the FBI paying an informant in the mafia and arguing that the FBI was running the mafia.
Yes. Even if the FBI was paying, you know, Don Corleone, right? You know, or like in The Departed, right? The Jack Nicholson's character is an FBI informant. Is the FBI propping up the mob in Boston in that movie then? Like, that's hard to say. Like, most people would say no if he's a confidential informant. And like, CIs are controversial for lots of reasons, because it means that law enforcement is turning a blind eye to lots of things. The SPLC is not law enforcement, and they maintain that they did nothing illegal. They didn't encourage criminality in any way, and they didn't actively engage in producing any hate or any extremism, and they didn't work with these people to do those things. So, and this program is no longer in existence. They don't use it
anymore. And how long has it not been in existence? Like, maybe
I'm not sure on that specifically. I haven't done the deep dive into this. I've read what the SPLC is now saying, and I've read the indictment and everything. So yeah, I don't think this case holds a lot of merit, but we'll see.
It forces them to spend a lot of money and resources and time defending themselves.
Right. And there are lots of organizations that the SPLC has designated as extremist groups or actual hate groups that have ties to the Republican Party and specifically to the Trump administration, that would prefer that the SPLC would just go away. And that is, that truly is what a lot of this is about. And, you know, I think that this, no matter what happens at the end of this now, there's this indictment that will be hanging around the SPLC's neck. And that's going to be a convenient thing for a lot of people on the right whenever the SPLC is brought up as a expert in what is and isn't hate. This will be a thing that they'll be able to, like, oh, yeah, the people who paid for it, the people that propped it up, they were indicted. Like, that's a pretty good line, and will be used and will convince a lot of people who don't look very deeply into this thing, because who has the time, to be like, well, now I don't know what to believe.
Well, it's the same reason why a lot of people with no reason hate the ACLU or an Oklahoma Care. It's like,
right.
It's just.
Right. And like, that's by design for a lot of these things. And so that, like, then all of a sudden it's like, well, then what, then who is the arbiter of these things? Who is good at this stuff? And like, you know, what, who can we believe and on these things? And that muddies the waters here.
Yeah. The conversation might be, oh, Grant, we don't need that.
Right. And like that, if that happens to the SPLC, that'll be a shame, because they are one of the last places in the country that tracks these things and does it better than anybody else. Yeah.
We have packed a lot in.
We have.
To this hour. I have to keep notes. I think I did a pretty good job segueing it. She would say something, I'd be like, that's to our next topic. This is perfect. But I want folks to understand that they need to be following you. Make It Make Sense with Grant Herms.
Yes.
Mimspod.substack.com. I've got it memorized now. And they can find you on YouTube, Make It Make Sense with Grant Herms.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have going on this week? Not only with Make It Make Sense, but also Make It Make Nonsense and Things You Forgot from Civics Class.
Yeah, Things You Forgot from Civics Class, which dropped on Monday this week, was about how primaries work. So we are hitting primary season that starts basically in 2 weeks for everybody. There are like 5 states that already had them. So sorry if you live in those states and I missed you. But it's a good refresher anyway for how your primaries work. There are 6 different kinds of primary elections across the country, which I actually didn't know.
I thought, I'm going to have to read.
I only thought there were 4. Yeah. And so there are 2 more that I didn't know. And it's super interesting. And some are better than others. They're not all created equal. Certainly, if you're an independent voter, you want to switch parties this election or just cross party lines, depending on your state. That's a lot harder. And so it's interesting. But we are heading into like primary season from now until Labor Day. And so it is, you should know what you're dealing with. The reporting from this week is the Department of Justice is pulling a bait and switch on voter fraud. They started by saying that they were looking for massive voter fraud. And then they were like, actually, it's non-citizen voter fraud. And now they are saying it's about normal clerical error and voter roll cleanup stuff. And they're just hoping we don't notice. And case in point, their latest demands are from here in Detroit. And they're using cases that they say prove fraud and they don't. And I know because I covered the cases gavel to gavel when I was here.
Yeah.
So the reporting is all about that. And you should be aware that they're trying to say that these things are really nefarious when they're not. And they're just hoping that you don't notice.
Well, it's an important reason for folks to have a healthy news diet and don't just skim the headlines.
Yes.
Take the time to read for understanding. I think that's super important.
Yes.
What do you have on the Make It Make Nonsense?
I think I'm going to talk about the fact that I am like nursing a injured knee right now. And I'm like feeling my age. And I've spent the last week kind of coming to grips with the fact that like I have to actually do a warm up when I go to the gym now, and I can't just like hop into it. And I've not enjoyed that feeling.
So Grant, you are 34. Am I
34,
right?
34. Yeah.
Okay. I'm 55. Here, I'm just going to and everybody out there watching this my age, you're going to just giggle. 40, your sleep starts to go away. You're not going to sleep 8 hours ever again. The bathroom trips at night will be you go up, get up once, then it'll be twice, and then it'll be once every hour, and you have to get medicine for it. All right? And here's the worst part of this. I've run 3 half marathons. That's no longer in my future because doing yard work hurts. It's just, you know, arthritis and all this stuff. It's just crazy. You're like, it's not going to impact me. It impacts everybody.
I thought that I could just go to the gym, just start doing jump rope without warming up, without stretching, and I couldn't walk the next day.
Right.
And so here I am.
Oh, welcome to your mid-30s.
The wheels are falling off, yeah. Ryan.
Yeah. It's all good, man. I've just found that walking, water, a great holistic chiropractor. I happen to have one here in Oklahoma City, Dr. Catherine Haken, and it's no ad or anything. She's just amazing. Have one of those in your life.
Do what makes you feel good, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Absolutely.
So for Grant and Make It Make Sense and Ryan from Oklahoma Memo, that's me. We will talk to you next week. It feels like rain, I shut my eyes. I can smell the sky when I'm